supporting WHYY Penn Medicine, helping to find new cures for cancer. With life-saving clinical trials and advanced surgical techniques, Penn Medicine is offering more hope for patients everywhere. Learn more at PennMedicine.org/cancer. Penn Medicine, what's next?
Welcome to You Bet Your Garden from WHYY in Philadelphia. I'm your host, Mike McGrath, and we got a jam-packed show for you this week, Cats and Kittens. In the question of the week, we will talk about a different kind of wild strawberry. Not the inedible little thing that vines its way through your lawn, and not the tasty little alpine strawberries that I'm always talking about. What kind of wild berry is it? We will let you know. And we're also going to talk to Elizabeth Milroy, who is the author of a new book called The Grid and the River, about how Philadelphia came to be such a green, green city. In the meantime, lots of your green, green phone calls at 1-888-346-9499. Doug, welcome to You Bet Your Garden.
Thank you so much, Mike. I appreciate you taking my call.
Well, thank you for making it, Doug. Where are you, sir?
Well, I'm in Trenton, South Carolina. That's right near North Augusta.
Okay, very good. What can we do for Doug in South Carolina?
Well, I was interested in putting in some zoysia grass, and I wanted to know what's the best way to do that. Can I go with seeds, or should I do the hydro?
Well, I'm not sure what you mean by hydro. Now, zoysia is a grass from Asia that is a warm, weather-loving grass that should do really well in your climate. It can survive the coldest winters. It can be grown all the way up in Minnesota, but it's not green for very long. Where you are, it might turn tan and get a little bit dormant over maybe a 2-3 month stretch in, quote, winter time. But it's going to be a green grass for you most of the year. And more importantly, it's going to take your summertime heat beautifully. Now, typically, zoysia grass is installed vegetatively via plugs. There are sod farms down in Florida that grow these big acres of zoysia grass. And when you're ready to install it, which is generally in late spring, early summer, you send away, and they send you either sod with a little plug cutter, or they send you little plugs, and you prepare the soil, and you put these plugs in. And then zoysia grass is a spreading grass, so it fills in very quickly. In the past couple of years, it is my understanding that zoysia seed has finally become available. I don't know a lot about the seed. I can tell you that it didn't exist 5 or 10 years ago. So this is a relatively new concept that you can sow zoysia grass from seed. I don't see any disadvantage to you buying the plugs, unless you're tempted by the fact that you have a supply of seed handy nearby at like a local garden center or something.
And that's true. I do have one that's local, and I wanted to see if the seeds would work best for me. But based on what you're telling me, I might be better off with the plug since it fills in, you said, relatively quickly.
Yes, it does. Now, you say that you've seen zoysia grass seed in bags for sale at these stores.
Yes.
And there's different brand names?
Yes, there is.
Oh, okay. Well, what I would do is I would, first of all, my gut instinct is I would install it vegetatively. I would get the plugs. But I imagine the seed is probably less expensive. And if you prepare the surface, well, those plants are probably going to spread really well. So I might want to contact my local state extension office and see if they have a preferred seed for your area. And not just South Carolina in general, but whether you're close to the coast, whether you're in an area of wintertime dryness, whether you're in an area of high humidity, one brand might work better than the other. So I know it's tempting if the bags of seed are there. That is very tempting because then you just prepare the surface really well and sow the seed. Although I'm going to put my money where my mouth is and say that I think if you bought a bunch of plugs and you planted them kind of close together, I think you would have a much less of a problem with weeds early on. as opposed to starting with a bare surface and seeding. If you till it up, you're always going to bring weed seeds to the surface. But if you just put in plugs and you don't have to manipulate the soil very much, in your climate at this time of year, that grass is going to spread like nobody's business. And I think it'll be filled in a month if you buy enough plugs.
Wow, that'll be great.
So check out the pricing. I mean, if it's hugely different, you might want to do the least expensive one. But I can tell you for a fact that putting in plugs has been found to be really a great way to get this type of lawn established very successfully, and it's been done for decades and decades.
Mike, I really appreciate you, and I'm going to call you back and let you know what my results are.
All right, Doug. Good luck, sir.
Thanks again.
All right. My pleasure, sir. You take care. 1-888-346-9499. Kate, welcome to You Bet Your Garden.
Yes.
Yes. Yes, here too. Kate, how are you?
I'm great. How are you?
I am doing just ducky. Thanks for asking. Where is Kate Great?
I am in Berwyn.
Berwyn, PA?
Yes.
What can we do for Kate in Berwyn?
Well, I am an old school weeder, but as I'm getting older, my knees aren't going up and down as well as they used to. I'm looking for a solution that's not going to hurt the bees. And someone told me I could use vinegar for weeds instead of Roundup.
Oh, yeah. I mean, Roundup is the devil's juice. You know, you don't want to go near that stuff.
No.
The thing about Roundup is less than with bees. It's deadly to amphibians. So when it gets into the groundwater, it kills frogs and toads like mad.
Oh, geez.
Now, the issue with any weed question is, where are the weeds? What's the situation? Are they in a lawn? Are they in a flower bed? Are they in a vegetable garden?
Mostly flower beds.
Okay.
And the vegetable gardens, I still weed, but...
Well, what kind of mulch are you using to prevent weeds in the vegetable beds?
We just have the non-dyed, root mulch.
Oh, okay, root mulch. I presume you're talking about something like licorice root?
Yes.
Yeah, it's not the worst mulch you could use. Arborist wood chips, true fresh wood chips from a local tree trimming service would be better. And the best mulch of all would be to shred and save your fall leaves and put down 2 inches of them, because they actually do a great job of suppressing weeds. And earthworms love to live underneath leaf litter. So using the leaves, you've got a very attractive mulch, and then the earthworms are transforming the soil underneath. That's a win-win situation. Now, what kind of weeds we got? We got grassy weeds. We got broadleaf weeds.
Grassy weeds, mostly.
Yeah, see, grassy weeds are the toughest to control because, you know, there's this broadleaf weed killer, the term. There's nothing special about what's inside, but the broadleaf weeds hold the herbicide. They've got a broad leaf. It's like spraying it on a garage door. It
right.
stays on there and it kills the plants. Grassy weeds are much better at having anything sprayed on them slip and slide away. If you want to do something this season, high-strength horticultural vinegars are okay. I don't think the 5% vinegar that you can get in a supermarket is going to do anything. Because if you look at those big gallons of white vinegar, they say reduced with water to 5% acidity. So
okay.
There are horticultural vinegars that range in strength from 8% to 20% acidity. And they are very powerful, especially if they're sprayed on plants that are a little drought-stricken during a hot and sunny day. Now, you must wear eye protection when you spray vinegar. You don't want to get in your eyes. You can't have the dog anywhere near you with the possibility of him running into the spray. After you're done spraying, there's no danger to anything. But like any herbicide, you also have to protect your wanted plants. It's non-selective, you know. So as with all gardening situations, essentially you're screwed, blued, and tattooed. So what I'm going to suggest instead is get a couple of kids over, you know, hire some people for a day, bring some friends over, and the day before, really saturate the soil. You know, have a hose running on the bed and move it around for like 24 hours to where the thing is just soaking wet. and then have a pulling party. You want the grass to come up in big clumps. So you want to reach down low. You want to pull slowly. And then all those grassy weeds can be composted. They're going to turn into great compost, especially if there's a lot of soil still around the roots. And then using the cleanest mulch you can, put down 2 inches all around, and then have your spray bottle of vinegar ready. And if you see any little blades of grass coming up through that mulch, then hit them hard when they're small and young. But it sounds like a situation where you want to do a knockdown with a pulling party, mulch 2 inches deep. No deeper than that, or it'll prevent rainwater from getting through. And and then you just have some little stuff to take care of.
Cool. Thank you.
All right?
Yeah, that's great, Mike. Thanks so much.
All right. Good luck, Kate. Well, it's time for me to take a little break and remind everybody who has a hugely productive garden that you can donate a portion of your harvest to the homeless and the hungry. The best way to find out how is to contact your local food bank or nationwide, the organization Feeding America. But don't go looking for all that information just yet, because we'll be right back with how William Penn planted a green city, the fabled wild strawberry that actually tastes good, and more of your fabulous phone calls. I'm Mike McGrath, and you're listening to You Bet Your Garden from WHYY in Philadelphia.
Support for You Bet Your Garden is provided by the Espoma Company, offering a complete selection of natural organic plant foods and potting soils. More information about Espoma and the Espoma Natural Gardening Community can be found at espoma.com. And by Burpee, celebrating their 141st year of providing treasured heirloom varieties, hardworking hybrids, seed starting, garden supplies, and more. Burpee offers no treated seed or genetically modified organisms. Information at burpee.com.
Welcome back to You Bet Your Garden from WHYY in Philadelphia. I'm your host, Mike McGrath. Coming up later in the show is the only, quote, wild strawberry, that nasty little vining thing with those inedible red button-like fruits, or is there a wild strawberry that tastes good? We'll tell you about that berry that is worth the hunting for and take more of your fabulous phone calls. But now it's time to welcome our special guest, Elizabeth Millard, author of The Grid and the River. Elizabeth, welcome to You Bet Your Garden.
Thank you, Mike. It's a pleasure to be here.
You may hold the record for the heaviest book I've had to page through here.
Well, there's a lot packed in there.
So, Elizabeth, people who listen from outside the Philadelphia area are always listening to me brag about how great our park system is and how it just extends through all the different neighborhoods of this city. And that extensiveness is no accident, right? This was Billy Penn planning it literally almost before there was a Philadelphia?
Well, he was the inspiration, certainly, because we'll remember that Philadelphia was originally a planned city. William Penn actually drew up a plan for the city back in 1682. And he included five green squares that would be landscaped parks, not just open areas. And so by the end of the 18th century, beginning of the 19th, as the city is beginning to really grow, people said, we need more green spaces. And one of the really interesting and exciting characteristics of Philadelphia's park system is how many watersheds are protected by the park system. So that there's a whole system of rivers and creeks that go through the city park system. That's quite unusual.
I loved reading about the five original squares of the city, because I stumbled upon that, and then I had to turn a couple of pages to see that the fifth one is that actually became City Hall.
Right.
Because growing up in Philly, you can rattle off the four squares, except that one of the squares, Logan Circle, was turned into a circle from a square years ago, but has exactly what you're talking about at the center of it. One of the things I always want tourists in Philadelphia to see is the fountain that represents the Delaware, the Schuylkill, and the Wissahickon, one of the most beautiful pieces of public sculpture and beautiful waterways and frogs that spit water into the air, right?
Right, and of course that sculpture was designed by Alexander Sterling Calder, who's the father of Alexander Calder, who designed mobiles. And that's another important part of the history of our park system, is that it was very closely tied to the fact that Philadelphia very early on had a municipal water system. That is, you could buy water from the city rather than a private company. And so the fountains are reminding us of how the park system and the rivers, which from which we got the water, are linked.
One thing that your book reminded me of, the city was really tiny in the beginning. It was just this almost settlement along the Delaware, which was this gigantic river that was perfect for shipping and stuff. So of the four existing squares, which was the first to be actually developed into a public park?
In fact, the first true public park in Philadelphia was none of the four squares. It was actually what was called State House Square, which is the patch of green behind Independence Hall. And that was laid out by a man named Samuel Vaughan in 1785. And he wanted to plant what he called a kind of garden of unity with specimen trees and shrubs from each of the 13 colonies. But the space wasn't big enough, so he ended up planting elms, and which he bought from Bartram's Nursery, of course.
Well, let's explain for people who aren't that familiar that John Bartram was one of the great plantsmen who both bought and sold seeds and plants to and from Jefferson and Washington and overseas, and really helped establish that whole concept of a seedsman.
Exactly. And, of course, his farm was on the Schuylkill.
Bartram's Garden.
Bartram's Garden, yeah, which is now part of the park system and has been preserved and is a wonderful place to visit. State House Square, that's the first true public park. And then in
Sam, but as you say, the green area behind Independence Hall is very small.
Very small. And it was actually walled in, so it was very contained. It wasn't really until the 18-teens and 1820s that the Eastern Squares, what we now call Franklin and Washington Square, were actually laid out as parks with purposeful plantings and walkways and benches and the like. Before that, of course, they were simply open areas that had been used for random purposes, including as graveyards.
Let's see. Washington Square, to my mind, is one of the most famous, quote, graveyards in the world, because underneath Washington Square, which is right behind this green area that you describe, contains the remains of all the heroes unknown heroes of the War of Independence. It's
yes.
Sacred ground.
Well, and even before that, it was also an important burial ground for African slaves. And so it's also a very important slave burying ground and a very important historic site for African Americans as well.
So we've got Franklin Square, which is down at the base of what would eventually become the Ben Franklin Bridge that
right.
goes back and forth from Philly to New Jersey.
Yeah.
Then we've got Washington Square, which is very close to Independence Hall and Carpenter's Hall. So when these were originally laid out, did people use them like parks that they were used to from from Europe, or was it a very American kind of way of doing things?
No, they were really copying the practice in Europe. And another thing that I discovered is that a lot of standard histories of urban park planning in the United States date the beginning of the park movement, if you will, to the mid-19th century and Central Park in New York.
Which, by the way, I want to mention, is a totally created area.
Totally invented, yes.
It's not like they found this wonderful little pristine area in the middle of Manhattan. They drug everything there.
Totally, totally. Everything's planted, even the rocks. Yeah, exactly. But what I discovered is that there were a lot of people talking about public parks in the 18th century, in Philadelphia certainly, and elsewhere, and they were looking to large parks in Europe, like Hyde Park in London, for example. They were also looking at the city squares in cities like London and Paris and other cities. So when petitions, for example, were submitted to city councils, people used the rhetoric of health and recreation. They already knew the language of why parks were important. It just took a little while to nudge the city farther along the way. And, of course, yellow fever epidemics helped a bit as well.
Exactly, because a park was a place you could get out of this crowded tenement. You could get out of this what was felt to be foul air inside the frames of buildings.
Exactly.
You could get out into the fresh air and be outdoors. And I would imagine even back then people understood how it added to the value of a city.
They did. They did. The thing to keep in mind, of course, is how slowly and strangely Philadelphia develops.
So, of course, it's slowly and strangely. You said Philadelphia.
Well, true. But it meant that really until the early 19th century, pretty much anybody in Philadelphia could get out in the countryside very quickly by walking. I mean, if you walk 2 miles to the Schuylkill, it was not heavily developed. So the real push and need for open green spaces becomes increasingly a function of the growth of the city by the mid-19th century.
And Rittenhouse Square, it was so hilarious. I hope I haven't gotten this wrong because I read this part of your book a while ago. But Rittenhouse Square, as anybody in Philadelphia or the suburbs knows, that's synonymous with money.
Mm-hmm.
A Rittenhouse Square is where all the big high-rise apartments are, where people who have money live, and there's fabulous private homes, and it's along a wonderful stretch of Walnut Street, which has like high-end stores and restaurants. And if I remember correctly, before they could begin to develop actually Rittenhouse Square, they had to drive the cattle out, or people were grazing sheep there or something.
Well, people were grazing animals in all the squares. really, you know, one of the problems with the squares is that William Penn never actually legally transferred ownership of that land to the city. So nobody really knew who owned it, and so no one paid attention to it until after the Revolution.
So this is like the stuff out west with the ranchers. This is like, I've been grazing my cattle here for years.
Why not, you know, and keep going? So it wasn't until after the Revolution that the city actually gained legal control of the space. In fact, there are some indications that the land was almost sold off. And so, again, it's a function of how slowly the city is moving farther west. And by the 1840s, people were beginning to build around both Logan Square and Rittenhouse Square.
Now, Philadelphia itself was pretty much chosen to be where it is to a large degree because of the greenery that was available, because of the confluences of the rivers and the Wissahickon Creek and everything like that. I mean, it was... I can only imagine, what was it like when it was pristine, when it was just parks and trees and waterways?
Penn actually initially planned to settle his city south of here. This was not the first choice. And in fact, it was his agents who came over before he did who changed the location of the city precisely for what you described, the proximity of the Schuylkill to the Delaware. You know, it's hard to talk about pristine nature because that's a man-made notion, and we don't know what it was like. Certainly, we have to remember that this area was already well settled by Europeans before Penn got here. The Swedes were here, other English settlers were here. There were a lot of settlements in New Jersey, so the pristine nature was being sort of chopped away at fairly early on. Another thing to keep in mind is that even though that 2-square-mile area that would become Center City, Philadelphia, was still forested until 1777, north and south of the city were farms and estates, and so that was pretty much cleared by the early 18th century.
So we know that early on, when before air conditioning, before modern plumbing, before electricity and everything like that, these open spaces were actually vital to human health. But lately, it seems like there's been a resurgence, a huge resurgence of interest in green public spaces, so much so that people are almost like inventing new places for them to be, like the fabulous High Line Park in New York.
Right, right, right. Actually had long conversations with friends and colleagues about just how do you define open space? What is it? What is open space? What is green space? Those are cultural constructions. Different communities have different views of what green space and what parks are and how they should be used. And, you know, when we look back to North America in the 17th and 18th century, it's a function of who owned land, how that ownership was enforced, and who could have access. One of the things that happened when when the Fairmount Park Commission was created in 1867, for example, is that they started publishing rules and regulations, and you weren't allowed to swim in the river anymore, which is probably a good thing for your health.
Yeah.
So that's you know, there was also a big debate in the city. You mentioned Penn's original 4 squares or the 5 squares. And the debate that developed by the end of the 19th century, I discovered, is that some people said we need a great big park along the river to protect the water supply. And there were other people who were saying, but I live in Kensington. I don't have time to get all the way over to the Schuylkill. We need smaller parks that are dispersed throughout the city. And so by the end of the 20th century, Philadelphia's park system had become a kind of mix of all these different kinds of open spaces that you describe.
And today, that seems more true than ever.
Yeah, yeah, exactly, exactly.
There's nothing, I believe, that adds to the value of a community more than even a small park or a community garden somewhere nearby within walking distance.
I would agree, although that was a driving motive behind many of the park developers in the 19th century. They would say, if we create a public park, then the real estate values will go up in the vicinity. That was really something that had happened in New York around Central Park. It didn't really happen in Philadelphia in quite the same way because, as you mentioned, Central Park is an invention. It's really an artist's creation. And Central Park was an 800-acre park in a 24-square-mile island. Because of the size of the island, real estate values were quite high in New York. In Philadelphia, a 2,000-acre park doesn't go very far in a 130-square-mile city. And so it didn't quite work in the same way. The other thing that happened in Philadelphia is that because many of the parts of the Fairmount Park system along the Schuylkill and the Wissahickon were not designed, they don't have clear borders.
Which is something that I love.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
As you're taking what they now call the Kelly Drive, the East River Drive, along the Schuylkill, the portion of Fairmount Park on the land side is just wonderfully undisciplined. I mean,
yes.
It's just all over the place.
Mm-hmm.
There's all these old structures that were once walkways and lanes, and now they're almost follies, and it changes every quarter mile.
And the fact that there are so many historic houses and structures, which are, of course, the houses that were built by the people who owned the original estates, and I think one of the things that's really interesting about Philadelphia is that we have a city park that has 2 railroads running through it and an interstate, which actually makes it a little more interesting than something that's this pristine kind of invention.
All right. We have been speaking with Elizabeth Milroy, professor and department head of art and art history at Westfall College of Media Arts and Design at Drexel University. You must need another half a business card to get that one on there.
That's true.
She is the author of a huge, here we go, A huge and weighty and fun tome called The Grid and the River, the history of Philadelphia's green places from 1862 to 1876. And I find it fascinating because there is this confluence, there's this wonderful geometry of the waterways and then the man-made grids laid on top of that, and how, despite that, nature really seemed to just be able to come through and always be present. Philadelphia is, I think, Penn's green city that he wanted.
It's much greener than many people give it credit for.
All right, Elizabeth, thank you for being on You Bet Your Garden.
Thank you, Mike. It was a pleasure to be here.
Well, it's time for me to take a little break and remind everyone that we are in the sweltering days of summer. And that means it's more important than ever to water wisely. That means watering for long periods of time. Drip, drip, drip for an hour or two or three. Watering no more often than twice a week because it's important for plants to dry out in between waterings. And always water in the morning, never in the evening or in the heat of the day. But don't go looking for all the details under W at the A to Z Garden Answers section of our website just yet, because we'll be right back with wild strawberries and more of your wild phone calls. I'm Wild Mike McGrath, and you're listening to You Bet Your Garden from WHYY in Philadelphia.
Support for You Bet Your Garden is provided by the Espoma Company, offering a complete selection of natural organic plant foods and potting soils. More information about Espoma and the Espoma Natural Gardening Community can be found at espoma.com. And by Burpee, celebrating their 141st year of providing treasured heirloom varieties, hardworking hybrids, seed starting, garden supplies, and more. Burpee offers no treated seed or genetically modified organisms. Information at burpee.com.
Welcome back to You Bet Your Garden from WHYY in Philadelphia. I'm your host, Mike McGrath, and we're in the stretch now, cats and kittens. In just a little bit, we will talk about a different kind of wild strawberry. Not the nasty little vine that's invading your lawn, nor the alpine strawberries that I always rave about growing. We'll talk about the Virginia wild strawberry after a couple more of your fabulous phone calls at 1-888-346-9499. Michael, welcome to You Bet Your Garden.
Hey, Mike, how you doing today?
I am just ducky today, Michael. How are you, sir?
I'm doing well. Glad to hear you say that.
And where are you doing well, Michael?
I'm from Birmingham, Alabama.
But
I'm in an airport at Atlanta right now.
Oh, okay. Well, you sound pretty good for being in an airport. Very good. What can we do for Michael Are you on your way back to Birmingham?
I'm flying out to Key West right now to be the best man at my best friend's wedding.
Oh, you poor dear. What a terrible, terrible place to have to go. Well, you'll have to give Hemingway's house a tip of the cap for me while you're out there.
Absolutely. I'm sure it will be a miserable time.
Yeah, exactly. What can we do for you, Michael?
So I'm actually growing a cucumber right now, and the issue I have with it is, you know, I have male and female flowers, and it seems to be pollinating really well, but every time a fruit starts to grow, you know, poof, it disappears. I'm not sure if it's falling off the plant. I'm not seeing anything on the ground. You know, I'm not sure if the chipmunks are the ones that are stealing my cucumbers.
Okay. All right. This sounds very doable. Now, this is back in your garden in Birmingham. Is this a flat earth garden? Is it raised beds?
So I just moved into the house, and I really wanted some vegetables, so I planted it flat earth. I do plan to do raised bed gardens next year.
Okay. That's fine. So is it supported, or is it laying on the ground?
So it is trellis.
Okay, good.
I have a big stone wall behind the trellis, and it's grown past the trellis onto the stone wall. It's about 6 feet in height right now.
Mm-hmm. So this is both common and uncommon for cucumbers, and especially zucchini, that you'll get, you know, flowers, you'll get female flowers, you'll get little fruits form, and then something will happen and they'll fall off. This is currently happening with a couple of my zucchini plants, but I can tell you the little fruits are there on the ground. So I know in my case, it's just plant stress because we've had really dry times, really screamingly wet times, and some really hot times. You say it's growing in flat earth. Are you feeding it anything? Is there compost in the soil?
There is compost in the soil. And for the first about 12 weeks, maybe 6 weeks, I was feeding it Job's Organics. It's kind of a, you know, vegetable plant food.
Okay. And so you got a really big plant so far.
I do. It is a monster, and it's kind of taking over.
And you say that you do see chipmunks.
The house I live in is definitely infested with chipmunks. You know, there's chipmunks all over the garden.
Oh, that's right.
And
you said there's a stone wall, right?
Yes. So they have created little nests in the stone wall. I know this because my dog goes crazy every time he goes outside, you know, to the stone wall.
Right. So I think definitely chipmunks are eating your cucumbers. There's a couple of things you can do when you get back. I think you have to physically protect the fruits this year. What I would do is I would get some chicken wire, and then once you see a female flower and you see a little fruit developing, I would make a little cage of chicken wire around that, or even like put a tube sock over top of it, or some people would staple a paper bag over top of the fruit, you know, because once you see the little baby fruit, you don't need the flowers to be pollinated anymore. A lot of farmers who grow really high quality crops like those apples and stuff that arrive individually wrapped in big gift boxes, they will actually bag their fruits. They'll take little like brown paper lunch bags and they'll staple it over the developing fruit to protect it from the critters. And as you can imagine, you can also make little chicken wire cages or something like that. And then maybe next year, knowing that you're going to have to face these creatures, you'll cage the whole plant in something that will allow bees to come and go to the flowers, but will have holes that are too small for chipmunks to get in.
All right. That's definitely great advice. I would have never thought of doing that.
Yeah, because stone walls are where chipmunks live, Mike. So you're going to have problems with them long term. You might want to plant away from the wall and then think about caging your plants so that you can get some of the fruits.
Alrighty. That sounds like a good plan.
All right. Well, good luck to you, sir, and safe travels.
Thank you, sir.
All right. Take care, man.
All right. Bye.
1-888-346-9499. Amy, welcome to You Bet Your Garden.
Hi, Michael. Thanks for taking my call.
Well, thank you so much for making it, Amy. Where are you?
I'm in Roswell, New Mexico.
Oh, you are not.
I am.
Have you seen the saucers?
I don't know. It's up for debate.
All right. Well, what can we do for you garden-wise?
Well, garden-wise, I made a big mistake before I read your article. I added horse manure to my garden. And the third time I started rototilling it in, I thought maybe I should have read up. And I found your article on the reasons why not to add manure to your garden. And one of them was, if you put in plants that bloom, which for me is tomatoes, I do tomatoes,
right,
then it's not good because there's a shortage, I believe you said, of phosphorus and potassium.
Well,
manure.
Right. What it is the manure is so nitrogen rich, and nitrogen is the food that grows big plants. It will grow huge plants, but the nitrogen is so overbalanced, so to speak, that it inhibits flowering. People who use horse manure or poultry manure, they end up with the famous 20-foot-high tomato plant with two tomatoes on it. And you tilled it in, which is even worse. Now, was this hopefully completely composted horse manure that was all no longer hot and smelly?
Yes. I don't know if you would call it composted. It was already dry and very lightweight.
Oh, okay. So, you know, there's a lot of different levels. There's the muck when it comes out of the stalls, which is the fresh horse manure mixed with the bedding. And then by the time it sits around for about 6 months, especially in your climate, it's going to turn into something that just looks like rich black dirt.
Well, these were, we would call them, they were still apples. You know, they were round.
Okay. So when did you till this in?
It has been probably a week, maybe a week and a half, probably 2 weeks by tomorrow.
Have the weeds started showing up?
No.
Okay. They are going to. Horse manure that's not completely composted is notoriously weedy because, as you know from being around them, they don't have very effective digestive systems, and a lot of the material they eat passes through them. So after it's composted, most of the weed seeds have been cooked out. Now, the best you can do now is to balance it. You can get some rock phosphate. A little bit of rock phosphate goes a long way. So not too much, and the nice thing about rock phosphate is that it'll provide phosphorus to your bed for a good 3 to 5 years. And then a nice natural source of potassium, I'm thinking maybe something like green sand. That's something I'm going to need you to look up because I don't add these kind of nutrients independently. But you can find good organic sources of those two nutrients. Unfortunately, you're going to have to till them in again. Then I'm going to suggest that before you plant, you do what's called a stale seed bed. After you till in the added nutrients, you're going to level the area with a hoe or something, try to get it nice and flat, and then water it for like 20 minutes every morning for like a week. And I predict that it's going to be full of weeds at the end of a week or 10 days. That's when you sharpen up the blade of that hoe and just slice all of the weeds off at the soil line. That will prevent 95% of those weeds from growing in your garden over the summer.
Okay.
But no more horse manure. Horse manure, even completely composted, that's for sweet corn, potatoes. It's a great food for lawns, but not for flowering plants. For that, you want a true mixed compost made with yard waste and other things, not composted manures. What I'd like you to consider doing is go back to our website, go to youbetyourgarden.org, go to Garden Answers A to Z, go to R for Raised Beds, and just consider taking one part of your garden and making like a 4x8 raised bed out of it that you will never walk on, and then put some test plantings in there. I think you'll wind up creating a raised bed garden because there's no tilling. Tilling is only for gardens that are constantly walked on, but neither one is doing any good for the plants. The walking is compressing the soil, and the tilling is releasing all the nutrients and creating weeds. So that's why we espouse raised bed gardening. You create these wonderful islands that you never step on. So after you get them all set up, you sell the tiller on eBay.
Okay. I did not realize that's good information about tilling. I did not realize that.
Yeah. If you want all the details and literature connections, read the no-till article at our archives as well.
Okay.
All right.
Great. Thank you so much.
Good luck, Amy. And, you know, if you see strange lights in the sky, just get down to the basement, I guess, you know.
No basements out here.
Uh-oh.
We have to hide in the closet.
Yeah, there you go. I've seen that movie. All right. Good luck, Amy.
Yes. Thank you, Michael.
All right, as promised, it's time for the question of the week. The wild strawberry that isn't a weed. Alexis Landis, producer of You Bet Your Garden, take over with a very lengthy and interesting question.
Sure, Mike. David in Ridley Park, PA writes, I heard you mention wild strawberries on a show last year and how they were used to develop modern strawberries. I was happy to hear that discussion as I have a story about them. About 25 years ago, we were visiting friends in early July who live near Sellersville, PA, and they told us they had wild strawberries in their back field. We were skeptical, but they told us that the plants were fruiting, so we took a walk and finally noticed some small plants with the right-shaped leaves. After some searching through the leaves, we found a few ripe fruits that looked like miniature strawberries, about a quarter inch wide at the most. They burst with a flavor that was at least as intense as any full-size strawberry I've ever tasted. We've always liked wild berries and asked if we could dig up a few and take them back to our home in southern Delaware County. The small plants had barely any roots, but they took hold and spread in every direction. They now cover an area of about 200 square feet. During the early summer, we can generally find a few berries a day for several weeks. I suspect that birds and slugs are also getting some. They are so hardy and persistent that they've pushed out some creeping Charlie. It occurs to me that I can use them as a ground cover in some of the small flower beds around the house. But should I fear setting an invasive loose in the neighborhood? We love seeking out the green leaves and white flowers on our hands and knees every spring. We only get 3 or 4 berries a day, but what a treat! Okay, so what's going on here?
Well, virtually all of our, quote, wild strawberry queries concern a weedy, vining ground cover with totally tasteless little red fruits. But the flavor David describes as, quote, sugary and aromatic in his email is much more like the tiny little woodland strawberries I've been growing for decades.
Ah, your, quote, alpine strawberries.
Right, except that my alpines are clumping plants. They got no runners, and they produce all season long, while the, quote, wild strawberries that David describes are early summer treats that grow in clumps like alpines, but also seem to send out lateral runners, like the despised lawn weed. Oh, and you know that weedy lawn-invading version is a member of the otherwise tasty strawberry family, the Fragaria family or genus. It's just the only one that doesn't taste any good.
So it seems like there are two tiny strawberries that taste good, one tiny strawberry that tastes awful, and a whole bunch of bigger strawberries that home gardeners and farmers grow.
Exactly. David's plants are Fragaria vesca, although some sources call them Fragaria virginia, or the Virginia strawberry. They occur over a wide range of the United States and Canada, and as David notes, bear small amounts of tasty fruits, but only in the late spring, early summer. Then you have the, quote, woodland strawberry, the cute little berries that were discovered in rural France and began to be crossbred and developed into our modern strawberries back in the 16th century. Although there's some confusion about lore and descriptions, these berries appear to be a lot like David's springtime treats and share the same scientific name.
And your alpines?
Well, the fruits of, quote, alpine strawberries are somewhat smaller than those true French woodland strawberries, but their flavor is just as intense. And they flower and fruit continuously all season long, as opposed to just being a springtime treat. Sometimes called Fragaria alpine, and sometimes identified as the cultivar Semper Florens, these are my berries. I started a few of the plants from seeds decades ago, and I've grown them in big containers ever since.
The original plants are fresh seed every year?
I've never sown any fresh seed. These are the original plants and their vegetatively propagated children. The plants are incredibly winter hardy, and they green up reliably every spring, no matter how harsh the winter was. They're very prolific, but after a few years, the clumps start to get a little overgrown with the old brown stuff from previous years taking over the outside edges. So I'll pull those plants out one by one, pull off a lot of the old brown stuff, and then replant them or even give those plants away.
But you don't grow them in the ground?
No, not unless you count the year they self-seeded into the spaces between the pavers in my patio. No, I like to grow them up real high in my biggest, tallest container so that the berries are easy to see and pick. And there's no bending. You won't see me down on my hands and knees for four berries a day. All I have to do is push away green leaves looking for little flashes of red. You know, they'd be perfect for hanging baskets, but those baskets might have to be protected over winter in colder climes.
And his fear that they'll spread and become invasive?
And we need more invasives that are delicious edibles. But I'd still keep them in tall containers like half whiskey barrels. These berries are very low to the ground, and bending over is for chumps.
Michael, couldn't you just say that it lacks joy?
Good point. Bending over lacks joy. And it's for chumps. Well, that sure was some interesting information about little bitty berries now, wasn't it? Luckily for you, the question of the week appears in print at the Gardens Alive website. To read it over in detail, just click the link for the question of the week at our website, youbetyourgarden.org. Gardens Alive supports the You Bet Your Garden question of the week. Yikes, my producer is threatening to annihilate my alpines if I don't get out of this studio. We must be out of time. But you can call us anytime at 1-888-346-9499 or send us your email, your tired, your poor, your wretched refuse, teeming towards our garden shore at garden@whyy.org. Please include your location unless you don't care whether we read your email or not. And visit our website, youbetyourgarden.org, where nobody cares about your location. And where you will find the answers to all those questions you are going to email us, as well as audio of this show, past shows, and our podcast. Elizabeth Perez Luna is executive producer of audio content for WHYY. Popular Ken Queter plays our theme song. Our engineer this week is Al Banks. Our social media director is Amanda McGrath. Check out her fine work at the You Bet Your Garden Facebook page. Rich Banowitz and Larissa Sapko keep our website tasty. Berry-loving Alexis Landis produces You Bet Your Garden for WHYY-FM in Philadelphia. Alpine Al Banks is our editor. Our associate producer, Brett Rader, has five for Al if he can yodel. Baseball been very, very good to me, Mike McGrath, and I'll drop a can of corn before I can see you again next week.
Your lady, your lady.
Radioactive roses, peerless pollinators, the famed banana of the north, and puckering persimmons. I'm Mike McGrath, and on the next You Bet Your Garden, we'll cool down your summer with a wilder blend of topics than the ingredients in a Singapore sling.